football. It has its ups and downs. There's the players who kiss the badge and kiss the club goodbye right after you've splashed out 100 quid to get their name on your kit. And oh, the A-list striker who always sticks it in row Z. The good news is the Ladbrokes Acca gives you auto insurance, free bets back and big odds boosts. So whatever else lets you down, it won't be your Acca. It's a gaffer of an Acca from Ladbrokes.
18 plus, online and mobile. Minimum odds apply. Maximum 1 to 3, £10 free bets per customer per day. Up to £50 of boosted odds. Restrictions and T&Cs apply. BeGambleAware.org. Take time to think.
Every runner knows the moment when everything clicks. When your legs lock into a rhythm, the aches float away and doubts fade. Replaced by a feeling of euphoria. It's why you lace up at dawn. Why a little rain doesn't stop you. Why one run turns into a habit. So next time you go for a run, chase that runner's high. Learn more about running and go wild at puma.com.
Welcome back to another edition of the Terry Collins Show, presented by Tunnel to Towers, supporting America's greatest heroes. Donate just $11 per month by going to t2t.org. That's t2t.org. I'm John Arezzi, and joining me direct from his home in Florida, former Mets skipper. And this week, celebrating another trip around the sun, Mr. Terry Collins. Terry, first off, you celebrated your birthday this past week. Happy birthday to you, my friend.
Well, thank you very much, John. I appreciate it. And, you know, I try not to make too big a deal out of them these days. You know, there's been enough of them in the past. So, but it was, you know, it's nice to know that I'm still here.
Yeah. And a lot of people remembered your birthday. I know you probably got the text and the phone calls and everything else. But, and as we looked at the social media, Bartolo Colon, the Mets posted something. Marsh, I think we got a photo of what the Mets actually put up. For Terry, and there it was, a big happy birthday to you. And that, of course, created a little social media explosion. And some of the fans, Terry, that you've interacted with and met at some events, this is a guy that Andy, who you've met before at some events, and fans, Let's Wish TC a great birthday. And Lisa G is another person who you've met a few times, and they really just all wanted to wish you a happy birthday. So it was so wonderful to see that outpouring. And but like you say, these birthdays, they come, and sometimes you're like, all right, I don't want to hear about it no more.
That's about right. It's the way it is now, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. So we do have a special one for you today. We're going to be bringing on Andy Martino, who is reporting from Citi Field today, right from the dugout. So we'll have Andy on in just a few minutes. And before we get to that leadoff, and of course, we're going to have a special guest on talking with TC, our friends at Tunnel to Towers have put together a new story featuring you, and I know you've done a lot of great things for them. And so this 2-minute story, we get to debut here at the Terry Collins Show, and I know you haven't seen it. So Marsh, why don't we pull that up? And this is the new Terry Collins PSA story for Tunnel to Towers.
This world doesn't function without the armed forces, first responders who every day put their life on the line. When they retire, when they leave, no matter what's wrong with them, there's somebody there that's going to take care of them forever. And what Tunnels is trying to do to get these veterans help, you know, the $11 a month that's asked, you know, that's not very much money. And yet when you see what it's building, it's off the charts. You know, when you see the response when they walk in and tell some family that this house is theirs forever and ever, there's that builds out of their life.
Beautiful.
Oh, cool. Little girls, I am going to have her own room. That's the part that really warms your heart. And here's a guy, you know, he can say something now and the lights will come on, you know, in the smart home. And it's amazing. You know, when I ran the race, I didn't know what to expect.
3, 2, 1.
Crowds and crowds of people at 6 o'clock in the morning. The people that ran the race, they loved it. They loved every second of it. When you come through that tunnel, when you go down in it, and you run through all those kids from West Point, you know, that's the future of America you're running by. When you get through that tunnel and you come up the other side, the ROTC from the high schools and the firemen and the police that line it and cheering you on, and, you know, the adrenaline just rushes to the point. That's why I said, I'm going to finish this. I mean, it's one thing when you're just got a T-shirt and gym shorts on. It's another thing when you're carrying fire gear. I just think it's one of the greatest acts of heroism. The only thing he knew is that he had to get there and help out. That drove him, you know? I'm former Mets manager Terry Collins. The Tunnel Towers Foundation is very important to me, and I look for ways to try to support them any way I can. You can support their cause as well by donating $11 a month. Go to t2t.org. Let's go Mets, and let's help Tunnel Towers.
Oh, that's very cool.
Isn't that nice?
That's very cool, yes.
Yeah, so they'll be running that across different cable outlets. And their baseball involvement is really just still intensifying. I mean, not only with your involvement with them, and now they're kind of sponsoring this Pete Alonso countdown to him surpassing Daryl Strawberry for the home run lead. And they'll be taping more stuff in New York regarding the 25th anniversary of 9/11 in New York baseball. So their involvement with baseball, the Mets, and they're so appreciative of what you've done, Terry, and the fact that we can create awareness for them every week on this program. So when I saw that, I was like, I got to show it to Terry, you know, it was very cool. And they loved their association with you.
Well, as you know, John, if you ever get a chance, if people that watch this this podcast, if they ever get a chance to meet Frank Siller, they'll know what a special person he is and the impact he's made. And I tease him all the time about, you know, you shake his hand and in the other hand you're handing him a check the first time you meet him. He's just that kind of a guy. So it's one of the great things that I've done, and it's a pleasure and an honor to be a part of it all.
Yeah. Well, that's great, Terry. So let's get right to the leadoff with our friend Andy Martino. So let's get right to the leadoff. We welcome back to the Terry Collins Show, one of our favorite insiders covering the Mets and Yankees for SNY and SNY.com, as well as author of two highly touted books, most recent, The Yankee Way. It's our pleasure to bring back Andy Martino. Andy, how you doing?
I'm doing well, guys. You can't be doing any better than 11 a.m., sitting in the Mets dugout at a ballpark. This is when you look at your job and go, really, they pay me for this? So I'm doing pretty good. And I was talking to Terry right before we started. I'm about 10 feet top from where Terry stood for all those years while he was watching the game like a hawk.
Yeah, well, enjoy it. Enjoy it. We're glad you're there. I'm glad you're on today. It's always good to see you. I have a great time. You know, when you and I start sitting down talking baseball, we can use up some time, I'll tell you.
That's for sure.
Well, guys, it's Memorial Day is really the first real benchmark to kind of take a good look at a team and how they're doing. And before we get to the summer months, the Mets are right in it. They are now 13 games over 500, which is kind of their benchmark for the season so far. I want to get both of your opinions right now on the third of the season now come and gone. Get your assessments on how you both view the team after the first couple of months.
So go ahead, Andy. Start out.
Sure. I think that clearly we have a good team on our hands. We thought that would be the case. It's played out that way. They are not even quite meeting a lot of their individual expectations, and they're still in good shape. Second place in the division, certainly shaping up to be a playoff team. I still think they're the class of the National League East, and it'll settle out that way. You have a team where a number of guys in the lineup haven't really hit to their full potential yet, so there's still upside there. The pitching staff, we probably shouldn't be surprised, is, you know what I'm going to do right now? I'm going to call an audible, and I'm going to bring over somebody who you all know. I'm going to say hello. Say hi to Terry Collins and John.
Hey. Gibby.
Gibby.
What's going on?
Hey, Keith, I read something. Is today your birthday?
Yesterday was, yeah.
Well, yeah. Happy belated 45th birthday.
Yeah, thank you, pal. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about the state of the team, so I'm going to leave Gibby here. To.
All right, real quick, is this your expert witness right here?
It is. It's
a scary thing.
Yeah. All right, boys.
There you go. I thought that was worth the cameo
definitely,
for a moment there.
Definitely.
It certainly is.
Appreciate that. As I was saying, I think you have a good team. They're pitching extremely well. If there's one nitpick you could make about the Mets, it's the way sometimes they defend and catch the ball. That's a hard thing to address necessarily in season. It's hard to use a trade deadline to trade for defense, especially when the bench spots are kind of occupied. But really, that's a low-level concern compared to, I think, what's good about this team so far. They're the contenders we expected them to be.
Yeah, Andy, I agree. And I look at them. First of all, we all know that, you know, I always, before the season started, I used to kind of look at all the numbers of the players. And you look at their real good year and you look at their worst year and you kind of throw both those out and you kind of come up with this general idea of what to expect out of each guy. And you're right. And some of those guys haven't got to that point yet, and they will, because mm-hmm. their baseball cards tell you that. And so I think, there's going to be an upside offensively. I know they've had a problem, but, again, it's the game is changing where these power pitchers now are dominating a lot of the games, and it was never easy, but it certainly is getting harder and harder. But I still think, Juan Soto is going to hit. Of course, Lindor and Pete have had good starts. I think Brandon Nimmo is going to come on. I really think Jeff McNeil I think the more bats he gets, he's going to start to do his offensive stuff. Marte's, get him in the lineup a little, get him some at bats. I like their team. I do. I think they're the best team in the National League East. And their pitching is, if they can keep it healthy, and they've got these two guys coming back here pretty soon, it looks like. So they're in good shape. They're in really, really good shape, and it's going to be a fun summer to watch.
In the beginning of the season and spring training, especially in the off season, no one really expected the team to be driven by pitching, but in the early stages of this year, it has been. Between the starters have performed at a level on the relief side. They're getting great arms out of the bullpen, and Edwin Diaz, he's been pretty much on fire. Hasn't blown a save all year. Both of your opinions, is Edwin back to finally being one of the elite closers in the game?
I think, John, with Edwin Diaz, as with most closers, you're going to expect some ups and downs. But what we're seeing lately certainly reminds you of the peak Edwin Diaz from 2022, because he's mixing his pitches. Sometimes he gets a little heavy on the slider. Sometimes he gets a little heavy on the fastball. Maybe he's not feeling like he has the command of one of those two. But when he's really mixing them, it seems like that's when he's his most confident, most effective. So that's what we're seeing now. How long will it last before there's a hiccup? You couldn't really say about any closer. But he certainly appears to be pretty close to the best version of himself now, and he has been for a while now.
Yeah, and I look at him, Andy, I believe this. This guy, he pitches off his fastball, and now he's getting his fastball velocity's kind of clicked back up a little bit. He may not be that 100-mile-an-hour guy all the time, but he's back up in the high 90s. And I'm telling you, when you attack with your fastball, all of a sudden your breaking ball's better. It just, because the hitters have to go up there ready to hit the fastball. And in the big leagues, if you can't hit a fastball, you can't play, man. And so when you face a guy like Edwin Diaz, you got to channel, you got to charge, and you got to hunt the fastball, and therefore his breaking ball is going to play. And I agree, he's got to use it a little bit more. But some of the games that I've said I've watched where he's really gotten better is because his fastball has been so good.
Well, you're talking about
– and commands everything. And command of your pitches is everything. And you can the best pitch in baseball is strike one. And so when you got that kind of stuff and you get strike one and hitters, make pitching a lot easier.
I'm glad you brought that up, Terry, because I should have in the first answer. And that they were concerned, that they being the team, coaching staff, was concerned about Diaz's command coming out of spring training. The fastball command wasn't there. The velocity wasn't there either, but they weren't worried about that. They knew it was going to click in, and it did when the red light came on for the season, velo-wise. But command-wise, it was like not where they expected it to be. So now that that's back in place and shored up, that does seem like huge, huge part, not of any pitcher, of course, but for Diaz in particular, it was something they were watching. It's something that's better now.
Yeah, I agree.
You're talking about fastball velocity and being able to, you know, that's an important pitch. But on the other side of the coin, when you come to the catchers, Francisco Alvarez has had problems with the fastball so far this season. Carlos Mendoza has been given Torrens more opportunity. Give us an assessment of the catching situation. I know Torrens started for two consecutive games, but Alvi has had a couple of really good at-bats over the last couple of games. What can you tell us about Alvarez, Torrens, and what Mendy's mindset is right now when it comes to catching?
His mindset about catching is that they're both going to play. And that was the way Carlos felt about it when, and is it, if you can hear the plane, it's an authentic Citi Field experience.
LaGuardia Airport.
We got LaGuardia, right, as you well know, right next door. Both catchers are going to play. You have a winning player in Torrens who's helping the team win right now. And you have a guy who still has a ton of upside in Alvarez. So it's a manager's challenge, as I'm sure Terry can speak to as well as anybody, to work those young players in, but not spend too much of your major league time on development, which unfortunately Alvarez still needs to some extent. So there's trying to strike a balance there, and it's going to be a bit organic with if you're playing really well, if you're hitting, if you're defending at that position really well, you're going to play more, and that's what we're seeing with Torrens lately. But that doesn't – I don't think we're anywhere close to there being a situation where one of these guys is the starter and one of these guys is the backup. They're both going to play – and Carlos is going to look for ways to get them both in all through the course of each week.
And I know you got a better feel for it because you're around Carlos, but, you know, and I have been in those situations where, you know, but you've got a young player, and I know, you know, I just know Alvarez from watching him and how he loves to play. And, you know, he's obviously when he first got called up, he took the stage by storm, and injuries have kind of hurt him a little bit. And I know he's really, really trying hard to be the guy that everybody expects him to be instead of just going out and playing. Friends, I'm telling you what, you can't have a guy that's done a better job. You come in here as a backup guy and, you know, you lose your starting catcher and you didn't miss a beat. They haven't missed a beat. This guy can catch and he can throw. He's shut down the opposing running game. It's incredible the way he throws. So, yeah, I think they both should play. It's going to keep them fresh, and you know, and you start getting in the heat of summer. It's nice to have you could give those catchers a day off now and then, and not be affected by it. I think both of them are going to get playing time, and you know, you look at towards the end of the season where all of a sudden you got to make a decision. Hey, who's our best option? Because we're getting in crunch time, playoff time. You know, that guy might get some more playing time at the end, but yeah. I think they're both going to play until then.
You make a good point too. Whoever that guy is going to be fresher. I mean, we see how catchers wear down offensively often by the end of the season, certainly by the postseason. So you're right. Both of these guys get off their legs a little bit during the summer. That's going to help everybody.
I agree.
You know, speaking of evolutions and what's going on with players that are really coming into their own, Brett Beatty. I mean, since the last time we all got together, the evolution of Brett Beatty really has ramped up. I mean, not only is he playing stellar defense, his bat is on fire. And Mark Vientos was struggling a little bit defensively, offensively, but Mendy has great options there with this infield the way it is right now. Talk to us about what you've seen with Beatty. Now he's finally coming to his own. He's getting more playing time, and I know Terry, you've been a fan of Beatty since day one. So give us your assessment on Beatty remaining at third base, or does he? Like Carlos has played him at second as well. So talk to us about Brett Beatty, his evolution, and what you're seeing right now.
Go ahead, Andy.
Well, I think that the Mets did Beatty and themselves a tremendous service by not sending him down when he was really slumping in April. He was at a point where he was hitting low hundreds a couple weeks into the season, and it would have been – a justifiable move at that point to option him out. And they said, no, we believe in this player. We're going to give him more rope. And sure enough, what he did was he started to find his rhythm at the plate, probably more than he ever has consistently as a big leaguer. So by the time they had to send him down for a roster move, they sent down a more confident player who went down feeling like, no, I can play here. So when the opportunity came for them to bring him back up, he was in a much better place. He wasn't a guy who was coming off yet another failed stint in the big leagues. He was a guy who got sent down because of a numbers game, but they knew he'd be back. They knew he'd be good. And that's the way it's been. So we've always seen a talented guy. The issue has always been, does he have that confidence? Does he have that presence? Carlos Beltran has always talked about how Vientos has just got that thing in the box where he's ready to attack. And Beatty sometimes could seem a little passive when he was younger. And I just think we're seeing a player who may finally realize that he is a big leaguer. And that's a great thing. Now the Mets have a good problem to have because they don't really have a position for him. But as long as he keeps playing stellar third base defensively, they're going to find innings for him to be out there.
Yeah, I agree, Andy. And, you know, I go back to the same thing we talked about last year when they sent Vientos down. You know, he could have pouted. He could have went, you know, been all upset about it. Well, all he did is say, hey, look, I'm going to show you made a mistake. I'm going to get back to the big leagues. And did and came up and again, played absolutely brilliantly the rest of the summer. And when they sent Brett down, it was a move, a roster move they had to make. But you know what? He went down with a great attitude. He didn't go down and say, oh, you know, why was it? Why do I? He went down to, hey, look, I'm not, you call me back and you're going to, I'm going to be ready to show you I belong there. And he has. Yeah. And I know they got to swing the bat so well. They got to keep him in the lineup. I'm not a big, you know, proponent of Brett Beatty playing second base. But, you know, he is. And, you know, he's got it. Again, it's about having his bat in the lineup and having McNeil's bat in the line at the same time, getting Vientos some at bats. So, I mean, it's tough to manage those kind of situations. I think Carlos has done an absolutely great job doing it. Guys know they're going to play. They're ready to play. And that, you know, that's where the manager really comes into play. He keeps his guys ready to play. They know they're going to be in the lineup. And so those kind of young players are producing for them. And if they didn't have those kind of guys producing, they aren't going to be in the situation they are right now.
I got a question for you, Terry, as an infielder and player development guy. I completely agree with you. Brett Beatty is not someone who you'd see as a middle infielder long term. But we have seen since he learned how to get by at second base, when he plays third, it's like a different defender. He's making plays that he never used to make at the corner. Do you think that the effort to learn how to become a middle infielder could have made him a little more agile or better footwork or better confidence? Like, do you become a better third baseman by playing second for a while is what I'm asking.
Well, I will tell you, I think that might be really true, Andy. I think because, again, you've got to have different footwork when you're playing in the middle of the infield. And obviously, you know, when you've got the size of Brett, you know, you've got to really maneuver, be able. And in today's game, you know, they position the player so much better. They don't really have to rely on this great lateral movement. The numbers dictate, hey, we're going to shade this guy here, shade that guy there. But I will tell you, yeah, I think the fact that he's had to use his feet a little bit more in the middle of the infield has really helped him at third base. But I'll tell you what, he has played absolutely great at third base. And it's nice. And, you know, I had the luxury of having a real, real good one over there. So I know the importance of catching the baseball at third and anywhere in the field. But, yeah, and, you know, you brought it up earlier. As you get into the summer, this defense, it becomes pretty, pretty important. And so I know that one of the things they're trying to do is get these guys and to get them out on that field as much as they can so that in the middle of summer their defense improves.
Yeah.
Another good problem to have for the Mets right now is a guy named Ronnie Mauricio, who's back from injury and tearing it up in AAA right now, creates a possible hard decision for Mauricio. I mean, you have all of these talented young kids now who are competing and doing well at it. And I remember, TC, a few weeks ago, I had mentioned Luis Angel Acuña that he should be playing every day, and you just kind of chuckled and shook your head. But now, you know, with Mauricio down there, with the decisions that got to be made, talk to us about how they fit Ronnie Mauricio in, and if there's such a glut of all these young, talented guys, would it be better to kind of maybe move one of them before the trade deadline to open up some space and get something in return?
Well, you know, John, I think it's going to come down in those situations about what piece are you looking for? What can they bring you?
Yeah.
You know, and obviously there's other teams that are looking for young players and might be willing to move a veteran guy who's making a lot of money. But, you know, you got to pay for that. And some of that is going to be a young player. And fortunately, the Mets have him. But, you know, I've been on in organizations that, you know, have really, really good young talent. There's just no place for them to go.
Yeah.
And so the job now is to make sure that they show everybody that they belong in the big leagues. That's the only thing they can control is out there their play on the field. And what happens down the road, you never know, because we don't know next week if something happens and all of a sudden, you know, somebody gets a ball on the elbow or gets hit in the hand, and all of a sudden now Mauricio's burst on the scene and he's got to be ready to come in and help. And so, you know, it's tough to do it. I mean, I go back many, many years ago where, you know, there was a guy named Richie Zisk who won the Triple Crown in AAA and couldn't make the big league club.
Wow.
Because he had two Hall of Famers in the outfield with the Pirates. And you know what he did? He went out and was going to win another Triple Crown the next year. So, and that's what you've got to do as a baseball player. You can't worry about stuff that's out of your control. You have to worry about what you do, how you play on the field, and let David Stearns handle what he's got to do to find a spot for you at the major league level. Whether it's, you know, when I was the farm director, I used to tell our coaches, our job is to produce major league players. We hope they're Dodgers, but we got to produce major league players because eventually one of those guys is going to bring us a piece that's going to help the Dodgers be a champion. And so, you know, that's what the situation with the Mets are with some of these young players.
Yeah, absolutely. A guy came out of nowhere, it seems, recently, Jared Young, who has started for the last five games as the DH. Now, Jared was drafted in 2017, not by the Mets, didn't make his debut until 2022, and he wound up playing in Korea and comes back. The Mets sign him, and before you know it, he's in, and now he's performing. He's got his first two big league hits, including a home run. Talk to us about Jared Young. I don't know too much about him. Andy first, and then TC, what do you know about Jared? And he looks pretty good so far in this limited role so far.
Yeah, well, I know they had him in spring, John, and when you were down there, yeah, he got a good amount of playing time in spring training, and they liked him. There wasn't a spot on the opening day roster. It's just a good example of one of those little pro scouting successes where you identify some depth pieces. You make sure, as Terry well knows from the Dodger days you were just talking about, you make sure that your AAA team is as – you pay players well to be there, number one, veteran, good players – and that you have guys as your depth pieces who can come up and help you what is required. And then, you know, that's one of the beauties of a long baseball season, too, I think, from a fan perspective and in terms of the story of an entire season is Jared Young may or may not be there at the end, but the season's long enough where different people need to contribute and pop up and have these stretches over the course of a season for a team and its stars to end up where they want to be in October.
Yeah, you know, John, I don't know anything about Jared Young. I mean, I've only watched him play a couple of games here on television. But, you know, ever since I spent some time in the American League, I go back, you know, it's so different because in the National League, when you went to an American League park and you got a guy to DH, sometimes it was a day for you to get one of your regular players off their feet a little bit so you could DH him and still have his bat in the lineup. But, you know, you look at the real good American League teams, their DHs, they're dangerous. They're proven dangerous guys, big bats. And so it's, you know, the one thing that, you know, the Mets have been able to do is find some talent like this guy who has come up, put him in a position where he's going to, you know, he's so geeked up about, you know, showing that he belongs in the big leagues that he's in a good role right now, even though there's probably not a position on the field that he can play. He realizes he's got to maximize his opportunities as a DH. And, you know, you think about, you look at the Mets, you look at their payroll, you would think they'd have some big slugging, you know, DH kind of a guy that would be, you know, you plunk him in the fifth or fourth or fifth spot in that lineup, and he's a dangerous, dangerous bat. And they just haven't done it. And Andy brought up, for me, that's scouting. You know, we kind of get away from the backbone of the baseball, which are the scouts, whether they're the major league professional scouts or they're amateur scouts. Those guys are the ones that bring in this talent to convince the general manager. These pieces that we found can help you down the road. And I think the Mets have done a tremendous job in that scouting area.
Yeah, everything that's happening for this team, from the development of the players to who they're bringing up, and they're pretty loaded, minor leagues, major leagues. So we're looking forward to the rest of the season. I got one more before, you know, Andy, I know the game is going to start soon, and we appreciate you doing this remote with us. But I can't let you go without asking about Juan Soto, because you wrote a column for SNY.com, which was really talking about how Mike Piazza was offering some advice to Soto addressing the slow start. Talk to us about that column, the Piazza comments, and weigh in on your recent observations on number 22 in right field.
Well, not to correct you, John, but I think the Piazza interview was with Joel Sherman, a competitor of mine.
Well, so you wrote about it, though, but it was actually Joel that spoke to Mike?
I've certainly written about Soto and the things going. Joel did speak to Mike in that one in particular, but with Soto, certainly watched him very closely during the Subway Series from a distance a bit in Boston and all season, really just tracking him. And I think that Piazza made some strong points there about Soto's body language, how that matters, how it can be a difficult adjustment, and you can get down on yourself in that situation where all eyes on you as a star new to New York. It will turn around because he's too talented for it to not turn around. But in the meantime, certainly I think it'd be foolish to deny that there's been a bit of an adjustment period here, to say the least. And some of the body language that we've seen, and I'm not really talking about hustling because I think he kind of got a bad rap a little bit on a couple of plays, specifically getting out of the box, but just some of the not doing his shuffle, being the last to get out to his position in right field, there are things that he could do, and I think that was part of Piazza's point to Joel, was that, like, body language-wise, there are things you can do when you're adjusting that Soto should probably be pretty careful to do while he's in that process.
It's not easy to have your first year, you know, I know he was with the Yankees, but with the Mets, because Piazza went through it, Beltran went through it, Lindor went through it, and they all turned out fine. So, just wanted to get your viewpoints on that. And Andy, as always, you know, TC and I certainly appreciate you coming on with us.
It's always my pleasure, fellas.
Great to see you. All right, enjoy the day.
Thanks.
Ready to launch your business? Get started with the commerce platform made for entrepreneurs. Shopify is specially designed to help you start, run, and grow your business with easy customizable themes that let you build your brand, marketing tools that get your products out there, integrated shipping solutions that actually save you time. From startups to scale-ups, online, in person, and on the go, Shopify is made for entrepreneurs like you.
Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/setup.
It was great to see that wonderful 2-minute story with Terry. And of course, Tunnel to Towers has so much going on. And I want to give everybody a quick update on what's happening with our friends over at Tunnel to Towers. Always busy, especially during this Memorial Day week that just passed, and some great events that are coming up for Tunnel to Towers. Memorial Day, always a big one, as I said, for a group of Gold Star families. Tunnel to Tower delivered mortgage-free homes to the spouses and children of 25 service members who made the ultimate sacrifice. The recipients were in 18 states, coast to coast. It's part of T2T's commitment to honor America's greatest heroes. If a service member or first responder is killed in the line of duty and leaves behind young children, Tunnel to Towers will pay off their mortgage. As workers in the World Trade Center rushed down those steps, September 11, 2001, firefighters were racing up. And as a way to pay tribute to those heroic first responders, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation will hold its annual New York City Tower Climb Sunday, June the 1st. More than 1,000 people will trek up the 104 flights of stairs inside the new World Trade Center. The event will raise money for the Tunnel to Towers Foundation, which was started after 9/11. You could do your part by going to t2t.org. And coming up right here in my neck of the woods in Nashville, June the 2nd, former Major League player Wally Joyner is hosting his latest Tunnel to Towers golf event. Wally's a great friend of the foundation and brings some terrific former ballplayers and celebrities to help raise money for T2T. These golf outings around the country are a terrific way for supporters to have a fun day on the golf course while supporting the Tunnel to Towers mission. You can learn more about all of the foundation's programs by going to t2t.org. That's T, the number 2T.org. Donate just $11 a month and you can transform lives. All right, we're going to get to our special talking with TC, a look back with Sandy Alderson, right after this.
I'm New York Mets outfielder Brandon Nimmo. I have great respect for the work Tunnel to Towers does to support our first responders and our military. These are the people who keep us safe. You can join Tunnel to Towers in their mission to do good. By donating just $11 a month, go to t2t.org for more information on how your donation can make a big difference.
Now it's time for the 2015 Tears of Joy Rewind, remembering the NL Championship season with the New York Mets. It was a special talking with TC, and we're going to take a look back now with Terry Collins and the Mets architect for that team, Sandy Alderson, on their memories of that amazing year in 2015.
You know, Sandy, every place I go, and I do a lot of these podcasts for these different people that do Mets podcasts, and always one of the big questions always was about, you know, 2015 and, you know, what was it like in 2015? And I said, you know, the guy to answer that question was Sandy Alderson. He's the one who put all the pieces together, because I've discussed some of those lineups we had early in 2015. And, you know, there's always been the big question is, you know, what part of those things all of a sudden did you say, hey, like, I think we got a shot here, and then made the moves to make us as good as we end up being?
You know, Terry, that's a very good question, because I think if you, you know, looked at the probabilities and made a decision strictly on what was likely to happen, I don't think we would have made the moves that we did. But I think there were a couple of things. First of all, I give a lot of credit to the Wilpon family, because, you know, as we got up to the trade deadline, we weren't in a commanding position. We were behind. And yet, you know, we made the effort before the deadline, at the deadline, and subsequent to the deadline, you know, to add players. And it was one of the few times where most of what we did worked out. There were some deals that didn't happen. Wilmer Flores trade comes to mind that turned out well for us as well. So, but I think it was, you know, the willingness of ownership to go for it at that time. And we had the opportunity. There wasn't, there hadn't been an opportunity to go for it the previous 3 or 4 years. And so I'm really glad we did. And it was sort of against the odds, as I said earlier.
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, I stay in touch with a lot of the coaches, and one of the things we talked about was how all of a sudden, you know, front office Fred and Jeff and yourself got together and said, hey, look, let's make a run at this thing. And the pieces you put together, you know, Sandy, I've always said, you know, it wasn't just everybody points to Cespedes as being the key, and maybe he was the key, but you know what it was? It was the fact that we brought in so many good pieces. You know, Kelly Johnson came back, and Juan Uribe came back, and then we, you know, Conforto came up, and that allowed, you know, Michael Kadire to be a good bench, one of the best bench players, and the two relievers. People forget those guys because they always think about the lineup itself. But man, the job that Tyler Clifford and Addison Reed did was just off the charts. I mean, able to bridge that gap to Familia. So I mean, there were a number of trades, not just that one big trade, that made a difference for us, I thought.
No, I think you're right, and those are the deals that have to work out in order for the team to be successful. I mean, obviously, Cespedes was a huge factor, and you know, without him, we probably would not have gotten to the World Series. But at the same time, as you said, there were smaller contributions made by, you know, a number of different people. I mean, I remember a home run by Kirk Nieuwenhuis in Washington that was huge for us. So. Adding those little pieces, not at great expense in terms of, you know, player talent, but definitely made a difference, and were acquired under, you know, different circumstances. I said earlier, a couple of those were before the deadline. I think one of those relievers was after the deadline. But in any event, constantly looking around, and it was a credit to the guys and women in the front office put those pieces together.
You know, Sandy, for the fans who watch this show, I mean, you had a professional, I mean, you have a professional scouting staff and an amateur scouting staff. How many of those scouts, I mean, in your, on the professional side, how many guys did you have in the off or out in the field that were looking at talent?
Oh, we probably had 10 to 12. And then we obviously had people inside the organization representing those 10 or 12 and their viewpoints. And of course, you know, a lot of it can be followed statistically as well, but I don't really recall any of those smaller deals or even the Cespedes trade being, you know, driven analytically in a material way. It wasn't about, you know, some crazy science. It was about scouting for the most part, and then some common sense interpretations of their performance. You know, sometimes I remember we acquired one reliever. I don't know if it was in 2015 or not, but just as an example, making a decision between one or the other and acquiring a player because he was in the other league. And as a pitcher, you know, would not have been seen by most of the hitters in the league. So, you know, that's a data point, but it's, you know, it's not terribly analytical. So, a lot of common sense, I think, went into those decisions. And because they were low cost, low risk, my attitude is always, let's go for it, take a chance, see what happens. and if it doesn't work, you can try to do something else.
Yeah, well, I will tell you, you know, when you're sitting on that bench and you're looking down that what you have, the pinch hit, and all of a sudden, you know, we got the likes of, you know, Rebe and Kadire and, you know, Kelly yeah. Johnson. I mean, that put all the pressure on the other manager, like who you want to face, because we had a weapon for him. And that, I mean, I've said it ever since then, when teams start building, you know, start trying to build for, you know, a pennant chase or something, you better have quality backup players, because you know that there's going to be injuries. There's going to be guys who get tired. There's going to be guys get in slumps. And the fact that we had big league players to put in some of those roles in those places, I mean, that made the whole difference for, you know, as far as our team went.
Yeah, and in addition to being great depth, there was a lot of flexibility within those players because of their positional flexibility and right, left, et cetera. So, it all came together. And as you recall, leading up to the trade deadline was sort of a semi-disaster. 3 or 4 days in a row, we had, you know, we lost a game in extra innings in the rain. We had the the trade that didn't come off. I mean, there was a lot of stuff going on that we just had to persevere and work through. But it was a test of one's resilience over that 3 or 4 days, both on the field and in the front office.
So, Sandy, that, you know, the trade that didn't materialize, Wilmer Flores trade. How did that get leaked out? How did that happen? We talked every day, and so, and I knew that if something happened during the game, you would have called and said, "Hey, you got to get this guy out of the lineup." But the fans were down there cheering. David Wright came in the dugout, said, "Oh, you guys, we just traded Wilmer Flores." I mean, how did that become such a fiasco?
I have no idea how those things get out, but the fact is they do. And you know, at the point where we're in those discussions, I'm sure there was certainly people aware of the situation on the Mets side, people aware of the situation on the Milwaukee side, and the Major League Baseball had to be aware of what was going on because all of this was pending a physical, and the Players Association had to be involved. So normally is involved. So, you know, it could have come from anywhere. I just make the assumption always that things are going to leak out. My mistake was, not wanting to say anything until the deal was absolutely done. And, years before, I got criticized for trading Jose Canseco out of the on-deck circle. So, you know, I've had other issues with timing. But in this particular case, the fact that nothing was announced certainly was prudent because the deal was never finalized. And I'll tell you, in the 8 years or so we were together, seven, eight, whatever it was, I think that was the only deal that our doctors killed. It was the only one that our doctors said, no, we can't do this. Now, we've had other trades that have been nixed by doctors for other teams, but I think that was the only one that our doctors nixed. So when they said something, you know, we didn't take it lightly because they did. They, so seldom did they raise an issue.
Well, you know, Sandy, I know when you came in, you know, one of the things that was quite obvious is you were going to rebuild the team. I mean, that trade that you made with Toronto to get Syndergaard and Darno, and I know there was a third guy involved in that, but I mean, that was a huge trade, and you know, to get two major pieces for an RA, obviously coming off the Cy Young Award, but that was a huge trade. The trade that you made with Beltran to get Zach Wheeler. I mean, those were huge deals that changed our organization.
I'll tell you what was really important, starting with the Zach Wheeler deal, is that when everybody knew Beltran was on the trading block, as it were, and the commentators kept saying we weren't going to get much for him, and suddenly we get Zach Wheeler, who was one of their top prospects, and nobody expected us to be able to get that kind of value. It really was a point at which people started to have a little more confidence in our regime, if you will. And I said, wow, okay, they were able to do that. And then when we traded RA and got those players back, I don't think anybody felt we were going to get that kind of value either. And so during the years we were building, there were certain things that happened, and those were two instances that I think helped build our credibility. Now, I know you had David Wright on earlier. I think another thing that gave us credibility was David Wright, and not just signing David Wright, but before that, I don't know if you recall, but he sort of endorsed our strategy. He endorsed our approach to building the team. And that was huge also. I think that it really was a statement for our fans that I know I and I think others really appreciated the fact. It wasn't just that we signed him. It was that he made a statement in support of what we were doing. And I think that was another instance where we were given a little more time based on, you know, these occasional data points where things seemed to be going in the right direction.
Yeah, they were. I mean, there was so many pieces had to fall into place that I will tell you, you know, those last few years, you know, we were to be reckoned with. We had that good young pitching. And, you know, I remember when you called up, when we brought up Montero and DeGrom, I mean, you know, two young guys, and man, they just, you know, they, of course, Jake has, you know, really took off, and even today, Montero has become an outstanding pitcher. So, you know, I thought one of the things we did, and probably one of my most proud days as a Met, was the day we played nine players in a lineup who were drafted by the Mets, signed by the Mets, developed by the Mets, and we're now in the lineup at the same time. I thought that was one of the true, you know, things that our organization during that time should have been very proud of.
Yeah, no, I agree with it. And I, you know, that had much to do with Omar Minaya, as well as you know, the scouts that were there under my leadership. But you know, one of the greatest days, I forget what year it was, you probably remember it. I think we played a doubleheader, and it may have been in Atlanta. And Matt Harvey started one of the games, and it might have been Syndergaard who pitched the other game. But it was, you know, a doubleheader, Harvey and one of our other, maybe it was DeGrom, I don't know. But I can remember how excited and sort of nervous I was going into that day that these two young guys were on the mound for us against the Braves. I think it was the Braves.
But you know, Sandy, one of the things, I think one of the hardest things to do, and I obviously I spent so many years in AAA, and you know, you can only compare or talk about your guys against the competition you're watching them against. But, you know, when somebody gets called up, you know, and you're saying, oh, you're going to go to the big leagues, you know, as a AAA manager, you're sitting there saying, well, geez, I hope he does all right. The job that those guys did, those young pitchers, when they all come up, every one of those guys seemed like they were ready, whether it was Harv or DeGrom, even though Syndergaard was a little wild when he came up, he still, you know, he wasn't afraid to throw the ball. He wasn't afraid to attack guys. And, you know, Steven Matz, my God, his first two starts, you'd have thought he was going to be a gangbuster. And obviously we've had some injury issues with those guys, but still every one of those guys, when they got up there, they were ready. So I thought it was a real credit to what our minor league system had did. You know, those the pitching guys and the field coordinator and everybody else down there got those players ready for us.
Yeah, no, I agree. And if you look at 2016, I think the difference between getting in the playoffs and not was the arrival of a couple of other young pitchers. Seth Lugo was one, came up sort of mid-season, late season. I can't recall exactly when. But those guys made a difference. And every team says they're gonna win through their farm system. You know, we're gonna build up our farm system and sustain our success through the farm system. And yeah, everybody, the 30 teams, they all say the same thing. But the question is, how are you gonna actually do that, and are you successful? And so even where these teams, you know, tear down their roster and going to rebuild through the draft. The teardown is relatively easy. It's the build back that's difficult, and not every club is successful doing it. And I'm proud to say, and I think you would agree, Terry, that we never tore the Mets down. Starting in 2011, it was never, you know, we never intentionally. Maybe it was a mistake not to. But I'm not sure that New York is a place where you can actually tear down a team and not try to be competitive. But we never tore it down. We always tried to be competitive, didn't always spend the most money, weren't always as successful as we would have liked. But we never tore it down, and yet we still, within 5 years, got to the World Series and back-to-back playoffs for the first time in a while. So it can be done without tearing it down.
We will have more memories of that 2015 season next week when one of the clubhouse leaders from that season and one of Terry Collins' favorites, Michael Kadire, joins us, and that'll be on next week's show on another special Talking with TC segment. Now it's time for our amazing Hero of the Week, honoring Army Sergeant Will Hoyam. Brought to you by Tunnel to Towers. Let's go to that right now.
I've always wanted to be in the Army. It was everything I'd ever wanted it to be. I was going to say, the Army was the best job I've ever worked. The closest brothers you'd ever had in your life. We were about 3 kilometers, I think, from the finale of our mission when I got hit. I don't remember the most of it very well. Apparently the truck itself, the cab, got ripped from the truck and thrown about 30 feet away from the vehicle. Just a long, long hospital stay.
This smart home is going to the Hoyam family. They sacrificed their life and limb for us. So when these guys come home catastrophically injured, this is what they deserve, and this is what our foundation's given them.
I was not expecting it to be as big as it is. This is definitely huge.
Oh, this place is great.
The kitchen's probably my favorite part so far. Just the idea that I can actually look into the pot and see what I've got. The huge bathroom, the design of it, the layout, the whole house is just set up in a perfect way to make life that much better when I'm at home. The things that Tunnel to Towers Foundation has done is just a lot more than you would ever expect to get in your entire life.
I'm so grateful and appreciative to see that he has everything he needs and he can just exist in this space comfortably.
It's a nice reprieve from everything else. All of the normal, like, complications of being in a chair, this place is going to be had a huge load off for that. This seems like I will never have any of those problems again. And it's very uplifting to me. Tunnel to Towers is by far one of the best organizations I've worked with.
By giving $11 a month, you're joining us on our mission to do good and take care of Gold Star families, catastrophically injured service members, and first responders. Go to T2T.org now.
We'll have another amazing Hero of the Week right here on next week's show. We're going to wrap it up for this edition of the Terry Collins Show. And we always want to remind you that each and every week you could tune in to Amazing Conversations with Jay Horowitz, a New York Mets podcast hosted by the foremost Mets historian. Each week, Jay brings on guests from all different eras of the New York Mets, and it is a very entertaining show. So check it out. Subscribe to it now. Amazing Conversations with Jay Horowitz, available on all podcast platforms and on YouTube. Thanks to the Terry Collins Show Executive Creative Director Marsh and our researcher Dominic DiBiase. For Terry Collins, this is John Arezzi. We'll see you next time.